Welcome to the podcast, Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path, and I'm your host, Mike Allen. Robots, well, maybe you love them because they can do a lot of things, or maybe you hate them because one of the things they can do is take away jobs. But love them or hate them, they're with us to stay, and for that we can thank two Connecticut residents who joined together to bring us the very first robot ever in the world. Now, George Duval was the inventor with the patent. He was from Wilton. And Joseph Engelberger was the marketing genius from Newtown who took Duval's idea and made it a reality. And all this 65 years ago. We're going to focus on Engelberger because he's the guy known as the father of robotics. And here to tell us the story today is Ben Crouson. He is president of the Newtown Historical Society where Engelberger lived. And Ben is going to discuss this fascinating man's history. He's going to be along in just a moment. This week's trivia question. It was about 95 years ago when the first selectman of this town died from a gunshot wound. But was he shot by the persons he told a telephone operator had shot him shortly after he was shot? And what town did this intriguing case take place in? We'll stick around after the main program for the answer because then you'll know the topic for next week's show. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is brought to you by our sponsor, Yale New Haven Health. When people need the best quality health care, there's a reason they turn to Yale New Haven Health. In 1826, Yale New Haven Hospital became Connecticut's very first hospital. They were the first hospital in the U.S. to use chemotherapy. Yale New Haven was the first to introduce insulin pumps for diabetic patients, and they introduced the world's first intensive care unit for newborns. For more information about Yale New Haven Health, visit YNHHS.org. That's YNHHS.org. Well, maybe you've seen some of those videos online about robots and what they can be programmed to do. I saw one recently. It had a human-shaped figure that was actually carrying boxes, jumping and climbing, really just like a regular person, and it just left me shaking my head. But like all great inventions, it had to start somewhere, and that somewhere was pretty rudimentary and certainly not like it is today. Well, I was pleasantly surprised when I heard and learned that the robotics industry, that rudimentary start, was here in Western Connecticut. And the very first industrial robot, the one that would be placed on a production assembly line at a General Motors plant in New Jersey, was made in Danbury. Well, there are two people who teamed up to make that industry go. The first one was an inventor named George Duval. Now, George was born in Louisville, Kentucky, and he invented some memorable devices, including, believe it or not, the first barcode, the earliest microwave oven, you'll love this, it was called the Speedy Weenie, and an automated door opening system that was called the Phantom Doorman. It seems kind of natural to me that somebody who thinks up all these clever ideas would be the one involved with the first robot. Well, George got the patent for the robot, believe it or not, way back in the 1950s, and it was for just an industrial robot arm. It was a device that had a lot of the same flexibility and capabilities of a human arm, and it had a hand-like contraption at the end that could be used to grab items and manipulate them. But George needed help. He needed money to finance it. And just as importantly, he needed somebody who could find uses for this new invention and promote it to the world. Now, that man, it turns out, would be Joseph Engelberger of Newtown. Engelberger is affectionately known as the father of the robot. Duval is called the grandfather of the robot, and it took the two of them working together to make this whole thing come to life. Now, Engelberger was born in Brooklyn, but he moved to Bridgeport early on in life and then up to Newtown, where he spent much of his career. Well, as you're going to find out, it was a chance meeting at a cocktail party in Westport that actually brought these two men to each other's attention, and the rest, as they say, is history. And here to share that history with us is Ben Crouson. He's president of the Newtown Historical Society, the town that Engelberger called home. So, Ben, let's talk first about the fact that Joseph Engelberger was the father of robotics, as we call him, and his sidekick, George Duval, is sometimes referred to as the grandfather of robotics. And maybe you could start off kind of explaining how these two guys come up with these names.
Joseph Engelberger had gotten a master's in electrical engineering from Columbia University in New York. He was working at a railroad equipment supply company in Bridgeport in 1956 when he met George Duvall at a cocktail party. The story goes that they supposedly started to bond over the stories of Isaac Asimov. That wasn't actually true. I guess George Duvall's, one of his children said after he passed away that actually George didn't really have much interest in science fiction. He preferred focusing on things that he considered much more practical, and science fiction was not thought to be practical. Certainly Engelberger was familiar with Isaac Asimov. So he sort of had the idea in his head that robots could be used to benefit humanity, because that was a big theme in a lot of Asimov's stories. Well, George Duvall mentions this robotic arm that he's been working on that he's applied for a patent for. Engelberger almost immediately realizes that this robotic arm could have tremendous potential. His first thought for it was that it could be used in factories and whatnot to do the jobs that are considered too dangerous for people or that just have too much risk associated with them. He had the idea to develop it. Soon after, he started his own company. He ended up leaving the supply company in Bridgeport he was working at, supposedly because his division was shut down. And Engelberger starts a new company called the Consolidated Controls Corporation. Well, now that he's got all this influence in this company that he just started, he's got the perfect place to start developing this robotic arm that Duvall has designed. So they work together to further develop the idea and turn it into something that they end up pitching at first to car manufacturers. The first place that they managed to get it in use was, I believe it was a General Motors dealership in New Jersey. This was the first time that anyone had proposed using robotics in manufacturing. Prior to this, pretty much everything was done by hand, but bringing in this robotic arm, they ended up using it to handle freshly cast metal objects, to take them out while they were still hot and stack them somewhere else, which again, sort of went along with Engelberger's vision of having something that could do the dangerous jobs that humans really wouldn't want to do or wouldn't be able to do.
That's a very important point. And you know, a lot of people today, when you talk about robots, you say, oh, well, you know, they're going to take away jobs and AI is going to take away jobs. And certainly the union at the car factories was worried about this too. However, you hit on the key point, which was the robot arm was doing a job that humans would not want to do. And this is how they sort of got a toehold in there. And, you know, eventually that would change and they would do more and more. But that was a key point, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Engelberger did not want to take away jobs from humans. Again, going back to Asimov's stories and whatnot, you know, the idea isn't that robots are replacing people. The idea is that robots are helping people and assisting them. And so that was a key part of what Engelberger envisioned.
Now they get into GM. What did the rest of the automotive industry do?
Chrysler and Ford very quickly decided that, hey, if General Motors is doing this, we should probably be investigating this too. They quickly followed afterward and also bought more of these robotic arms. The robotic arm that they developed and ended up marketing was called the Unimate robot. And they made this under a company that they founded called Unimation, which was based in Danbury. The Unimate, initially, when they sold the first one to General Motors, sold at a significant loss. So they actually lost tens of thousands of dollars on the first Unimate that they sold. So this was a bit of a gamble for them. But it ended up paying off because General Motors loved it. The other car companies very quickly caught on and decided to do the same. It also very quickly spread overseas. The Japanese were very quick to pick up on this robotic arm as well, because they had been absolutely devastated after World War II. Tremendous numbers of men had died in the war. A lot of their infrastructure was gone, so they were looking to completely rebuild. This robotic arm was going to give them the ability to boost productivity, and the Unimate ended up becoming a key part of Japan's post-war recovery. Another way in which that it fits into Engelberger's sort of vision of robots helping people. So it didn't just help by improving the production process, but it actually created a future for Japan and really, in a way, made it the country that it is today. If you look at videos now of the robotic assembly lines, Honda or Toyota has a completely automated assembly line. you watch the video and it's made up of all these robotic arms that are doing all the various welding and holding pieces in place and all that. And it all goes back to Engelberger and Duvall developing the Unimate and selling it over there in the early 1960s.
So this entire operation, Unimation, at one point was the largest robotics company in the world. It was the first and the largest for the longest time. And then something happened, which was simply that Engelberger and Duvall had developed their entire robotic approach using the power of hydraulics. And suddenly it became a little more popular to build robots with electrical equipment. And even though Engelberger thought this was preposterous, it ended up taking over. And Unimation took a big hit on sales, and they weren't around too much longer, were they?
No, they weren't. I think it was 1982 they got sold to Westinghouse. But yeah, they were really only around for about 20 years. I believe the company was founded in 1962 and then sold to Westinghouse in 1982.
Now, one of my favorite stories about Engelberger is going back to this whole notion of our robots going to take away our jobs, and aren't they these faceless machines that, you know, mankind is not going to be able to interact with. He went on the Johnny Carson show in 1966 and brought Unimate, the robot, with him, and it was doing things like pouring a beer and having a great time on the show with Johnny Carson.
Yeah, as I recall it, it sank a golf putt too. It would be interesting to know what people's reactions were when they saw that on TV, whether they saw that as sort of a frightening experience or a hopeful one. I think we can be pretty confident that Engelberger saw it as a very positive glimpse of the future. But I imagine for some people that was probably scary, because some people probably had some of these jobs that obviously this robot could do.
The other thing was, so Unimate, you're absolutely right. Westinghouse ended up, I think, selling it to a Swiss company after the electrical part came in and hydraulics kind of lost favor and a Swiss company took them over. But then this was not the end for Engelberger. It was the end for Engelberger and Duvall. They kind of went their separate ways and parted amicably and went on. But Engelberger kept going, and he said he looked at his parents, who were at the time elderly, and he was looking at the care they were getting. And you referred to this earlier, that he was kind of looking for a way he could help have robots help elderly, infirm people in life and make their lives smoother, wasn't he?
Yeah. Of course, that's something, you know, any of us who have had parents or other older relatives that have gotten older and had trouble staying at home because they need someone to be there and help them and take care of them. It's still something we would probably like to see robots developed for today.
So he ended up looking at this and coming up with a version of a robot that he called Helpmate. And he sold the very first one in 1988 to Danbury Hospital. And this was the beginning of a pretty interesting new line of business for him, wasn't it?
It was. This was obviously a much more developed idea than the Unimate. His hope was that it would actually have some sort of ability for sensory input, so that if it was handing something to someone, it didn't do that too forcefully. You know, it had some ability to restrain itself based on what it could sense and feel. I don't know if he ever succeeded in doing that, but this was a big step forward from putting the robotic arms on the assembly line and instead, you know, trying to bring it into people's homes, make it something that was a little more everyday, a little more visible, and much more along his lines of robots really assisting and helping people.
I was actually in Danbury Hospital in the late 1980s and saw Helpmate, the original Helpmate, which the staff called Rosie the Robot. And this machine would carry hot meals, and they had different, you know, trays that were slid into Rosie the Robot. And Rosie the Robot could actually go over with its wheels underneath it, go over to the elevator, knew where the elevator was able to, I think they had some sensory mechanism, I forget exactly which, it was a particular elevator they used, and it went up to what floor to go to, it would get out of the elevator, would go over to the nurse's station. Nobody had to prompt it. There was no remote control like for my television today, you know, trying to figure out which channel to go to. This robot did it all itself. It was the most remarkable machine. And he ended up selling a couple hundred of these around the world, didn't he?
Yeah. It's important to remember, too, the Unimate, when he developed that, that had to be programmed to do everything. You know, you couldn't just sit it down in front of an assembly line and it knew where to weld a piece together or what piece to pick up and move away. They had to program it with every single movement and instruction it would need to do its job. And obviously the Helpmate was a huge step above that, being able to essentially make its own decisions. You give it a basic task and it knows how to get to the place it needs to be and to do what it needs to do without you programming every single step into it.
Now, in following Isaac Asimov's theories, as you've mentioned several times, the one area where Engelberger did not want to see robots, even though it was something that maybe humans wouldn't want to do, was in the military and killing other people and even getting bodies off the battlefield. He really didn't want to do that, did he?
No, he didn't. And again, this goes along with his vision of robots as helping humanity rather than really anything else.
In Newtown, he led a very sort of modest life. He was not in any sort of ostentatious, big, huge mansion or anything. He lived in a relatively small home in a very rural section of town. But he was very involved, particularly with the Newtown Men's Club, which is a mover-shaker organization in town.
It's an exclusive club, too. Their charter specifically limits their number of members. I was reading that Engelberger was interested in trying to expand that number and bring more people in, which I guess the other members kind of resisted. So that was a way in which he was involved in the community. I assume that probably means he was involved in other ways, although I have had trouble finding out exactly what those might have been.
But you hit on a key point, which is, I read about this with Henry Kissinger in Kent after he just passed away at age 100, that there were so many ways he was involved helping Kent that nobody knew about until after he passed away. And then suddenly people were like, oh, yeah, he did this. Oh, yeah, he did that. You know, very quietly behind the scenes. And I get the sense Engelberger was the same way.
I definitely do, too. He seems to have been a pretty modest man in general. If anyone had a right to brag, it was him. Not only just because of the things he accomplished, but the list of awards and honors that he was given just goes on for pages.
It's an amazing list of accolades, really, is what it boils down to, and yet it didn't seem to affect him.
Yeah. I mean, how many people have an award named after them that's given to people who make amazing discoveries in the field of robotics? Between that and, you know, he was given an honorary doctorate. He was given the Japan Prize, which is the Asian equivalent of the Nobel Prize. Obviously, the Nobel Prize is worldwide. The Japan Prize is given directly from the Emperor of Japan. So these were big deals, these awards that he got. You're right. It didn't seem to go to his head. He seemed to be someone who legitimately loved to learn about robotics. That was his thing. That's what he was passionate about. And that seems to have been the main thing that concerned him, that field of study, developing it further, and helping people with it.
Well, if we go back to a moment for this whole concept of machines replacing humans, there's, of course, the entire Industrial Revolution that came along where machines replaced humans all over the place. But one of my favorite examples in the more modern times is an ATM machine. Now, of course, this replaced bank tellers, and they've been around, I checked it out, since 1967. That's more than half a century now. They started in England and made their way over to the United States. Of course, if you go to any retail store now, you're going to find self-checkout lines, and that's the same story. But just recently, a friend pointed out to me a much, much earlier example of machines replacing humans. You have to go back to 1888, nearly 150 years ago. It was in the New York City subway station that, yes, vending machines first appeared. And then you put a mere penny in that machine, and out came a new chewing gum called Tutti Frutti. Well, that wraps up this episode of Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. On a personal note, my wife, very early on in her career, in fact, before we were even married, had a temp assignment at Unimation, where they made that first robot. And if that wasn't coincidental enough for this episode, as she was eating one day in the lunchroom, a guy walked in and introduced himself by saying, I believe I'm your cousin. Indeed, he was a long-lost cousin, one of the employees working on an early version of Unimates. Well, I want to thank our guest for today's program. He's Ben Crusan, president of the Newtown Historical Society. The answer to this week's trivia question. The question was, about 95 years ago, the first selectman of this town died from a gunshot wound, but was he shot by the persons he told the telephone operator had shot him shortly after he was shot? In what town did this intriguing case take place in? Well, the answer is Seymour. And next week on Amazing Tales CT, the mysterious shooting death of Seymour first selectman Ray Gilyard in the 1930s in his office has a number of fascinating twists and turns, and we'll get to the bottom of the case. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is a production of True North Associates, LLC. This is Mike Allen. Be safe, and please stay healthy.